China's largest online retailer has agreed to buy $200 million worth of premium Montana beef over the next 3 years. Looking out 25 years, we just gotta wonder, to whom will all the good food go?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, to whom will all the good food go? That's the question of the day. Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1132nd edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Montevideo who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Strubia on the boards. Jason, is our pre-flight check complete?
All systems are go.
Let's take off then. Folks, China has a lot of money, but is running low on food. The U.S., on the other hand, has a lot of food, but is running low on money. As Diane Bugard, the CEO of Rabobank Asia, told Nikkei Asian Review, and I quote, "Although the population growth has slowed down quite a bit in China, the demand for food is still increasing very, very much because of the wealthier population and the mid-market that is existing now. And furthermore," she says, "Asians may be getting wealthier, but their money may not be able to buy them all the food they need as the region faces a lack of arable land and low agricultural productivity." A good indication of where this demand might be taking the market came with a recent announcement by China's largest online retailer that it would be buying $200 million worth of Montana beef over the next 3 years and building a processing facility in Montana to boot. This sale bodes well for the domestic beef industry, which has been competing with much cheaper beef from Argentina, Brazil, Australia, and others. But it does raise some interesting questions. How can domestic beef compete in a market without mandatory country of origin labeling? How did the Montanans sell their beef to China when China can buy beef far less elsewhere? And to whom will all the good food go in 25 years? Well, those are the questions on the table this morning, and who better to go chew on them with than a couple of genuine Montana cowboys. We'll start with Bill Bullard, who is the CEO of RCAF USA in my own hometown of Billings, Montana. Bill, welcome aboard.
Glad to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Yes, quick question. Do you wear cowboy boots to the office?
I certainly do.
Okay. Just checking. See if we're still there. RCAF USA. What is RCAF? I always wondered why RCAF, R-CAF.
Well, it stands for Ranchers, Cattlemen, Action Legal Fund, United Stock Growers of America. We are distinct in that we represent only the farmers and ranchers who actually raise and sell live cattle. We don't represent the other segments of the multi-segmented beef supply chain. So we don't represent the multinational meat packers, the distributors, the wholesalers, or the retailers. We represent the family farmers and ranchers that actually raise cattle.
And from what we understand, there is a distinct difference between the needs of both parties in that supply chain, right? The differences between what the farmers and ranchers need and the differences between what the processors need are two different things.
Well, absolutely. The farmers and ranchers raise and sell cattle, whereas the multinational beef packers purchase and then purchase the cattle, convert it to beef through a manufacturing process, and then sell it to retailers. So our members are sellers. The meat packers are buyers. There's a natural antagonism between those two entities, and we know that by the term competition.
There you go. Well, also with us today, we have Brian Massard, who is the president of Montana Stock Growers Association. Brian, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, do you wear boots to the office?
Well, not every day. I got my snow boots on today, so Some days it's cowboy boots, some days it's snow boots, and some days it's irrigating boots. But, yeah, there's typically an array of them.
Well, good. For those city folks who are just tuning in and listening today to a couple Montana cowboys, what the heck is a stock? You're a stock, Montana Stock Growers Association. What's a stock?
Stock is livestock. I mean, that's basically what it is. We represent Montana livestock industry, which also represents a lot of Montana landowners. And so we are a communication service organization for the Montana ranching community.
Well, good. You know, in Montana history, typically the gold and silver and copper were on the west side of the Continental Divide and the cattle were on the east side. So both of you guys are kind of representative of that. Brian, you're on the gold and silver and copper side, the west side of the Continental Divide, in Helena, Montana, and Bill is over there in Billings, Montana. So is it still that way in Montana, whereas the cattle are on one side of the Continental Divide and natural resources are on the other?
Well, natural resources encompass the entire state of Montana, and I think when they ran out of gold and silver over here on the west side, they used a little of their money and invested in cattle ranches. And so we live in probably the most diversified area in the country. I mean, it's where the grasslands of the Midwest meet the mountains and the rivers and the trees. And so everybody wants to live here. Everybody wants to preserve it. Ranchers have been here for over 100 years preserving it. And so that's where we're at. But we still have mining. We still have timber industry. All have been affected by regulation and not so much. But, you know, eastern Montana, and Bill can tell you more, too. You know, they're different resources, you know, oil and natural gas over there now. So it's a different mining. But they've got those resources dipping into cow country, too.
Good. So still a lot of natural resources, and we tend to be farming those natural resources now more than we did in the past. Would that be a fair assertion?
Yeah, but the one key thing to remember is when we talk about utilizing these resources, they're renewable resources, and so they were made to be renewed.
Right.
They were made to be used, and so somebody's got to be out here that understands it and to care about it so that you know how to renew those things. Because a Montana rancher, there's not just one crop of grass that we use up and then we're done and we move to the next one. We're on our ranches. If we don't protect and preserve that water and the grass, we don't have it next year and we're out of business.
I guess that's kind of what I was trying to get at by farming it. You know, we're in one place and we have to take care of those resources and keep them going so that we can use them again and again and again. So I'd like to, for the benefit of those folks who do live in the city, of which there are many, I'd like to go through a quick thumbnail of how the cattle industry works. Bill started that process, but I'd like to kind of go through it quickly. Bill, let's start with you. What exactly does a cattle rancher do in the beef supply chain?
Well, they maintain a mother cow herd, meaning they care for the mothers, and they breed them with bulls and produce a calf every year, typically in the spring. The calf remains at the mother's side for 4 to 6 months, and then it is typically weaned from the mother and sold. So many Montana ranchers, for example, would sell that animal when it's about 6 months of age after being weaned from the cow. But that's only the beginning of the live cattle supply chain, because then the young animal is brought into a backgrounding feedlot or is turned back on grass, and where it produces another perhaps 300 pounds. And once the animal weighs about 900 pounds and it's now about a year old, it will then enter the feedlot sector, where it will remain for 120 days typically. And it will be fed on a high-energy grain diet in order to fatten the animal so that it is ready for slaughter when it weighs about 1,250 pounds. So the whole life cycle lasts about 12 to 18 months, somewhere in there on average. And the cattle rancher in Montana typically will keep the animal up until about 900 pounds. But then most of the meat packers have migrated to the central part of the United States, in the Texas, Oklahoma, Nebraska area. And so the feedlots have migrated there as well. And so that last 120 days of finishing is typically done outside of Montana and in closer proximity to where the multinational meat packers have set up shop in the central part of the United States that we call the Beef Belt.
Well, when we come back, I'm going to ask Brian. It seems to me like you guys are the good guys in the beef food chain, whereas the multinational packers are the bad guys. Am I right? Right back.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it, it's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back out there. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we're talking about the cattle industry. Specifically, we're talking with a couple of genuine Montana cowboys. Bill Bullard from RCAF USA, Brian Massard from Montana Stock Growers Association, talking about the beef industry and how China is buying into the Montana beef industry in a very big way. Before we go to that transaction, I'd like to learn a little bit more about the beef industry. It seems like you folks who raise cattle are in a good place. You're the cow-calf operators. You're raising the beef and then sending them off to the big meatpacking facilities that are kind of looked down on these days. Am I wrong, Brian?
Yeah, you know, we used to look down on them. 20 years ago, I was a member of RCAF, and, you know, I went to a couple of meetings and found out that they were, you know, heard that they were taking advantage of us, and they were controlling and manipulating the market, and so I got pretty excited about it, got pretty emotional about it, and you know, jumped on the bandwagon and went to spread the word, and I also simultaneously got involved. And I just went down there and spent a lot of trips, a lot of times meeting with the meat packers, telling them we have the best cattle in the world and they need to pay us more. And I learned through them that we don't ship cattle to them. So actually Montana ranchers do not sell to the packers and then the packers sell to the consumers out the back door. There's seven segments in this chain. Sometimes we sell to brokers. There's no difference between a stocker or a broker in the beef business. They'll buy some cattle, and if they can make some money, they'll turn around and trade it. So there's a markup right there. Mm-hmm. And then they'll sell it to maybe one of these feedlots. It could be a small farmer feeder in Iowa that's got 2,000 head of cattle. It can be a big feedlot in Texas or Kansas or Colorado that's got 100,000 head of feedlot or feedlot capacity. There's another markup right there. Then those guys sell to the packer. There's another markup right there. The packer breaks down the entire carcass. They sell the hides, all the organs, the entire meat on a daily basis. And then they sell it sometimes to these huge multinational retailers like Walmart and Costco and Kroger's and some of these other outfits. Or they'll sell to large multinational distributors who distribute to the United States and all over the world. We're working, doing a deal right now with an outfit, a large distributor in New York on Hunts Point, which where most all that beef, all the meat, all the protein goes to that one little area. Several big distributors there, and then they sell it to smaller distributors in those huge metro areas. So, and they deliver it to the retailer. Then he marks it up. So there's three more markups in that. And then the consumer comes in the front door of the retail store and says, I'm going to pay this much for it. Some days they pay a little bit more. Some days, you know, if they got families, you know, the husband wants something, the kids want a toy or something like that. They don't walk in that door every day to spend the most money they can on beef, and they're not beholden to us to do so. So we have to do our best job communicating our message, provide the safest quality, highest quality, the safest process all the way through, and give them that option because they have other options. Beef is not the only other option. And so we quit, you know, through that process that I learned, the packer said, if you want more money, here's our specs, negotiate a better grid, and we'll give you more money. And we did so. And we've been getting paid more money for our cattle for the last 20 years. And that's kind of exciting. We have been able to bust through that myth. It's still not enough. Would I like to get more? Do we have a lot more regulations? Absolutely. Would I like to get more? But the packers aren't always the bad guy. They're not the boogeyman. And there's certainly seven other sectors between me and the consumer that mark up that product and challenge our price. And so I've really changed my focus in the last 20 years, and I've learned to communicate. I've learned who those different segments are and what I've got to do if I want to add value on my ranch. I do know now between me and the consumer what I have to do. And so that's kind of the avenue that we take.
Well, then what you're saying is that you have to sell Montana beef.
Absolutely. You got to sell the name, you got to sell the quality, and you've got to be able to back it up because Montana is pretty. It's mountains and trees and water. And the best genetics in the world come out of Montana. But you've got to back those genetics up. You can't just say we've got the greatest beef in the world. All the bragging rights, this is the neat thing about the packing house, all the bragging rights for Montana ranchers begin and end on that rail.
There you go.
You know how your health program went because you know how many of them made it there. You know how your feed efficiency and your average daily gain went. And most importantly, this entire conversation that we're talking about is how good was your meat? There's a grading system, and it goes from standard all the way up to prime. And most of the meat is choice and select, and there's a few primes up in there. And so there's pay raises in there. There's incentives in there. Just like if you're a stockbroker and you make a lot of money for your clients, you're going to get paid more. And so that's what we do. We keep pushing for more. And the further you own that animal through the supply chain, you own more of that margin. And so ranchers can own them through the feedlot. They don't have to give up that margin. Ranchers can own them through on the other side of the packing house and sell to a distributor. And so there are new doors opening up in the last 20 years that we didn't have access to. And so, you know, that I call it a myth today that they're the boogeyman because so many things have changed and we have tremendous opportunity. And, we, you know, we just proved it with this China deal.
Well, let's take it to the international market now. You now operate in a new world order of open borders. The World Trade Organization said you may not have mandatory of country of origin labeling. So beef is beef. It's turned beef into a basic commodity, has it not, Bill?
It has. That's a big challenge. We've had a lot of the country of origin labeling. Really quick, started in Southwest Montana at our stock growers meeting in Dillon, Montana in 1994 when Bill Garrison was involved with the stock growers. And we've been on that and pushing it for so many years. And it's devastating when you want something. Ranchers really wanted something. The ranchers said, let's let the consumers choose. Let's see if they're willing to pay more. Let's see if they believe in safety and quality. But when the government gets involved, there's a huge time delay, and usually the end result is very convoluted, and it didn't even get close to where you wanted. And that's what happened with the last country of origin labeling deal. We lost in the courts four separate times, so it was time to scrap that and then come together as an industry, and let's figure out a better way to get that done.
Well, Bill,
Michael, let me
yeah, go ahead,
I could
Bill.
Interject here. The meat packers actually filed lawsuit against country of origin labeling.
That's
in
right.
Our U.S. district court, and the district court upheld the law on three occasions, and it went to the appellate court, and it was upheld. It was the International Tribunal the World Trade Organization that had ruled against country of origin labeling, not our domestic court systems. Our domestic court systems found it to be constitutional and statutorily correct. And so
agreed.
What we have now is a loss of sovereignty in which we have allowed this international tribunal to dictate to the United States what consumers can and cannot have with respect to information about their beef. And
so,
that's wrong.
So when somebody goes to a fast food drive-thru and orders a hamburger, they have no way of knowing where that hamburger comes from, right? Because there's no longer a country of origin labeling. So the package comes with beef, premium grade or whatever. But there's no country of origin. We don't know where the food comes from, correct?
Well, yes, but to be fair, the country of origin labeling law did not include food service establishments at all. It only addressed the meat that was sold at retail establishments like the grocery store. We presently have a lawsuit against USDA because it's now allowing the imported beef that is currently labeled when it comes into the United States. USDA is allowing the meat packers to unwrap that beef, remove the label, rewrap the beef, and then put a product of the USA label on the product. That beef could be coming from Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, Mexico, or any one of 18 countries that we import from. And so we filed a lawsuit because we find that to be outrageous, that the USDA is allowing the meat packers to hide the origins of beef to unsuspecting consumers.
And speaking of Brazil, I'm going to ask both of you, what on earth happened to the Brazilian meat that caused me and everybody else that knows about it to think twice about eating beef that we don't know where it came from? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. We have Bill Bullard, RCAF USA, Brian Massard, President of Montana Stock Growers Association. You, 831-479-1080, join us.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, on the food chain, at least on the beef side and perhaps on most other sides, the United States is the high-cost producer in a new world order of open borders, which means kind of we have to figure out some way of competing with low-cost producers that have the wherewithal to access the same markets that we do. So how are we going to do that? And I think specifically of Brazil and what happened to the beef industry in Brazil recently. And so let's throw that open. Bill, let's start with you. What on earth happened down there?
Well, what happened in Brazil is that the world's largest meat packer, JBS, Brazilian-owned, Brazilian-financed, came into the United States and is now the second largest meat packer here. But in Brazil, the principals of that corporation were caught bribing health officials and then exporting tainted beef in the international market. The principals have also been accused of insider trading, and there's a huge corruption scandal going on. But the important thing to consumers, of course, is here we had a foreign-owned entity came to the United States, became a major producer of beef through the manufacturing sector, and now it has been proven that this whole entity was a corrupt entity from the get-go. And that's a big concern to us, particularly since they came to the United States in 2008 after already paying a fine in Brazil for engaging in anti-competitive practices, meaning they were paying producers less than what the market would bear for their cattle. They were harming the financial interests of consumers. And nevertheless, the conventional beef industry in the United States welcome them here with open arms. And so that's a very big concern. JBS is too big to fail. It's a problem here in the United States. And from our perspective, we need more packers because now we have only four controlling 85% of the market. And JBS, again, is the second largest meat packer in the U.S. and the largest beef packer in the world.
Brian, do you have any comments on that?
Oh, I got a lot of comments. That's a big subject. So we're going to build a packing house in Montana, so maybe now there's going to be five. So that's kind of an exciting deal. If the country of Brazil had the same environmental regulations as the United States did, we would be extremely competitive. There's a big challenge down there with cutting down all the rainforest and growing crops. And the level of corruption in Brazil has been wide, well known for years and years and years. It was long before JBS came along. And yeah, we're adamant that anybody that wants to trade with the United States, they had better step up to our level, and we're not going to put up with it. So we've gone legislatively to all of our delegations that it is unacceptable to trade with a trading partner that is not willing to trade at our standards. Corruption is, we have zero tolerance for corruption. And so I'm really grateful for our inspection system, because regardless of what country this beef comes in here, the USDA has the safest inspection system. And so I am confident in that if you have a bunch of clowns in Brazil that thinks they're going to pull one over on the United States, that is not going to happen. That's going to get caught.
Isn't that the essential problem of the United States right now? We have done so much to chase away dirty industry, and then what we have done is run down to the box store and made in China because it's cheap. And so what we're doing is really not getting rid of any dirty industries. We're just exporting it to China. And speaking of China, how on earth did Montana sell China all that beef when China can buy that beef for a lot less money elsewhere? Brian, let's start with you. What was the first step? First of all, you had to get rid of the ban on U.S. beef, right?
Yeah, that's what opened the door. And so we've been, you know, at stock growers, we're always communicating, looking for ways, knocking on doors. How do we get trade? Because we're an export state. I mean, not only does the United States need to export for the beef producers to be successful, but Montana exports everything out of there. We don't process. We don't further process. We don't feed. We don't manufacture. We give up all that opportunity to other states. And so we've been looking on the feasibility for a packing house in Montana for, you know, 6-7 years now. And we really wanted to dive into that deep and say, okay, if we have an opportunity to export, even before China opened, we were working on this. Is it possible, or is it just an emotional feel good? Can we get through the permitting process? Do we have enough water up here? Can we recycle it? Can we do a good job? Can we compete with the feeders? Can we compete with our feed stuff to actually open up a finishing feedlot system up here and a packing house, and then export directly to whatever country or heck, whatever retailer or distributor in the United States that wants to buy it. So that's just free entrepreneurialism, capitalism. We're free to go for it. We're free to try to make things happen. And by just heading down that road and communicating and knocking on doors, this opportunity came to us.
Well, yeah, but the opportunity was there, but somebody had to be there to realize that opportunity. Your Senator Steve Daines pitched in a little bit there, did he not?
Yeah, he's been working on trade for, you know, every time we talk to Senator Daines, he's working on trade, trying to open up trade. And when President Trump got elected last year and the administration change came along, there was a lot of opportunities. You know, we got the announcement shortly thereafter that, you know, China was going to open up. And for the Montana stockholders, if somebody says there's an opportunity, we're going to be as quick as we can to that front door and start knocking on and say, how do we participate in that? And so through the Commerce Department, Senator Daines working legislatively and through the administration, those doors are open, and we just happen to be there because we wanted to be there. We want to export directly out of Montana. A lot of the Pacific Rim has been for decades wanting to get meat directly from Montana, and so we've been in the forefront there, and the opportunities showed up.
Well, you had to sell them something. What'd you sell them?
Quality beef, safe beef. It's people come from all over the world to buy seed stock from Montana, and seed stock is a registered bulls that go out and make the cattle, and then those cattle go on and become fed and beef. So we have that reputation of high quality genetics, and so that's starting to go, you know, worldwide. People share that. Feeders from all over the country come to Montana, and they pay more for cattle in Montana than what they can get them delivered for anywhere else in the country. And so we have that advantage. We have a lot of pride in our genetics, and so that has That's what's created this buzz. That's what's created these consumers. So when China delegations come to the United States, when Korean delegations come over here from all these other countries, not just those two, they want to get to Montana because they've heard we have superior genetics. And so that's what we had to sell them.
The genetics. But also, did you not have the fresh air, the clean water, the high mountain grasses? Oh, my goodness. If I'm a cow or a cattle herd, I'm looking to eat in Montana. Did you not have that to sell them as well?
Oh, excellent. Excellent point. Yes, we have that. I mean, you know, I love to talk about everywhere you find an endangered species in Montana in the West, there's a cow standing next to it, protecting it with open space. There's hundreds of thousands of miles of clean watershed and the trees and the grasses and all the feed that we raise to feed these cattle also produces millions and millions of tons of oxygen that goes up in the atmosphere.
Okay, we have to take a quick break, but I'm so hungry for Montana beef. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, Montana boy. And with some Montana cowboys and you, 831-479-1980, join us.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute." In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, as Diane Vugard of Rabobank Asia remarked, the Chinese market for food is expanding rapidly simply because China has more money. People, when they get some money in their pocket, they want to eat some good food. So that's the plan. China's great big internet company, JD.com, has entered into an agreement with Montana Stock Growers Association to buy $200 million worth of Montana beef. Presumably, they are going to be selling this beef directly to Chinese consumers. And presumably, the fact that this beef is from Montana will play a big part in their marketing efforts. And so is this a way around mandatory of country of origin labeling, Brian?
No, I wouldn't look at it as a way around country of origin labeling at all. You have a specific consumer over there that wants to buy a specific product, a specific quality from a specific area. And we're able to deliver that. Now, China can buy this company, JD.com, the country of China. They can buy beef from all over the United States from any packer, from any source. But they chose to come to Montana just because of what we just talked about on the last segment. I mean, we're able to show them that we can raise the greatest beef, the best tasting beef in the world, and we have the most sought after environmental area that the whole world wants to protect, and yet a lot of times they don't realize who's been protecting it for the last 100 years. It's been ranchers.
Right. Open space advocates and open space needers. Bill Bullard, looking at the way JD.com plans to sell Montana beef, I also see a lot of TV commercials for Omaha Steaks doing the same thing, are they not?
Yes, they are. They're selling a branded product, and Montana has its advantages, and Omaha beef claims their own different attributes to the beef product. Mm-hmm. But when we talk about China as a customer, from our perspective, that's great that we have a customer seeking a domestic product that strengthens our domestic supply chains. But if we look at the other part of this agreement, it's an investment. It's a purchase of U.S. property. And so we find it difficult to celebrate selling America off one piece at a time, and that's what China wants to do. China is coming to Montana for the same reason that JBS, the Brazilian firm, came to the United States, came to Canada, came to Australia. It's because they want to establish global supply chains where the origins of beef really don't matter, and they can seamlessly switch from one country to the other. And China is a new emerging investor in the United States. About 80% of our foreign investment comes from industrialized countries like Japan and South Korea and some European countries. But Brazil and China are now the new entrants into the market. And our concern is we should be protecting our critical industries, and the production of food is just one of those critical industries. And so we question the prudence of inviting a communist country to come in and buy assets in Montana and then actually control the fabrication or manufacturing process of beef. We like just China as a customer, even though China can be a fickle customer, as we learned in 2003 when they closed its border, and then turned around in 2007 and said, well, we will reopen our border, but we'll only take beef from animals under 31 months of age. Well, that was prior to our new trade policy. That was back when we were trying to use trade policy to influence foreign policy. And now, under the Trump administration, as Brian indicated, we have a more let's look at trade from an economic perspective and make some significant reforms, which we certainly support.
And with respect to trade, will not the good food always go to the big money? Brian?
Yeah. When people's incomes go up, they immediately start buying better protein. They start eating better. And so beef is always a winner. You know, protein is always a winner as incomes move up. And so that absolutely is true. Just real quick, this is not their packing house that they're building in Montana. My whole life, I don't want all these foreign countries taking over our country. I love our country. But we trade with China, and we want to export to China. They are so eager to get our product. It's no different than if Goldman Sachs said, hey, we'll give you some investment dollars to help you guys get this packing house put up. This is our packing house. It'll be our feedlots. It'll be our business structure. They're basically going to front some money, no different than a bank if we were working with Robbo or somebody else. And so we're free to enter into that exchange in this country, which is great. And we're free to set those limitations of, no, this certainly isn't a colonization of China coming up into here, because no land has been seized, no cattle have been seized, nobody's controlling anything. This is our deal that we negotiated, and we'll set the terms with our partner. The best thing about this is we can build a packing house, and we wanted to do that for 20 years, every rancher in Montana. But if you don't have a buying customer on the other end that's willing to have some skin in the game, your risk goes through the roof. And we didn't even ask them for that. They asked us how they could help us. And so we just have a business partner. It's our rules. It's our country. It's our state. It'll be our county where we do business at. But we just have an opportunity to export beef directly through China. And, you know, the way you look at it, maybe we're going to become the multinational packer, because we're buying cattle right from Montana ranchers, or Montana ranchers may own them all the way through our new packing house and sell a boxed beef product that's going to be exported to a country. And so there's all the middlemen, all the margin will be right here in this country. And that's what Montana ranchers have wanted for a long, long time.
And I guess that's why I was asking if it wasn't a way around that crazy mandatory of country and origin labeling dismissal by the WTO and a way of taking charge. This is the Food Chain, right back with one more great segment.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy it'll make you blush. Pledge 2 local bucks each day. Get 2 others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at metrofarm.com.
2x2. So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have exported so many of our industries to China, and as a consequence, China now has a lot of money. But it's running a little bit short on food. The U.S. has a lot of food, but is running a little short of money. And that leads us to a question of the day, something to take with you as you go along today and ponder on, and that is it better to have food and no money, or to have money and no food? Well, let's go quickly to the phones and see what Mr. Pierhart has to say. Pierre, welcome aboard.
Hi, Mike Olson and guests. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
I understand Montana beef is excellent, but the Japanese believe their Kobe beef is excellent as well. So my question, is there a meat-tasting competition like the French have for wine? And number two, do I hope they have the support community supporting agriculture and sell their beef locally, too?
Well, that's a good question. Let's start with Bill. What do you think?
Well, they certainly have tasting opportunities with beef. There's barbecue cook-offs that go around the country using beef. But I'm not aware of anything other than that. I don't. Maybe Brian's got some other thoughts there.
Brian?
Yeah, there's all kinds of tasting opportunities, and some people like Kobe beef. You know, the Japanese do, but they have so many people. No matter how much they like it, they need more beef, and so they do buy ours. And there's consumers out there that like leaner beef, and the Kobe beef is very high marbling, and some people just don't like that. And so yeah, there's great opportunities for different grades of it.
Well, okay, let's take the opportunity expressed in the reservations Bill made about selling our industry to China. And let's look down the road 25 years or so, and as we continue buying all of our stuff from China, all of our money's going to go to China. And so we just kind of wonder what's going to happen to all our good food when they have the money to buy it and we don't anymore. Bill?
Well, that's the big problem. China is a very shrewd modern-day mercantilist, meaning that they are out trying to capture the raw materials around the globe, and food, as you indicated, is their present target. And so they found a willing partner here in Montana, and it's not just this JD.com company. This is the Bank of China that's involved, too. You're really dealing with a state-owned enterprise that is able to manipulate their international trade agreements simply by having subsidies that are hidden. China's not a market economy either. So we're really dealing with a potential adversary, and I think that the investment side, again, is the problem. If China wants to be an export market for us, I think that's great. We should pursue that. But inviting China to come into this country to begin controlling and having control of our meat processing facilities, I think is detrimental to our long-term interests.
Brian, you get the last word.
Well, they're not our only customer. They've just offered some investment money. We're free to sell to whoever we want. We just happen to have it's not the country of China that's coming in and buying this. It's a company. And so we have the choice to sell. We're going to sell to that company, of course, because it doesn't matter if I'm selling to a company in New York or in China. Heck, people are just afraid of China. We do business with Russia. We do business with China. We love exporting to them, but there's thousands and thousands of products that are traded all over. There's investments that are made all over the world globally, and we're going to take advantage of that.
And we need the money. Bill Bullard, CEO, RCAF USA, Brian Massard, President, Montana Stock Growers Association. Save some steaks for me, please.
We'll do it.
All right, gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in The Food Chain.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.